Hello, welcome to Emory's Creativity Conversations podcast. This is our third season, with these introductory interviews taking place virtually. This podcast takes Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations, a live endowed speaker series on Emory's campus, and turns them into podcasts. I'm Maggie Becker, the host and producer of this podcast. I work for Arts at Emory and am an Emory alum of theater studies and creative writing. We are recording this season's interviews over Zoom to maintain COVID-19 social distancing precautions. I'm joined today by Stipe scholar and Emory artist Anna Mola to introduce the creativity conversation between composer and conductor Robert Spano and Rosemary McGee herself. The point of these introductions is to provide an exciting way to continue the conversation on creativity. Anna and I will chat about Spano's thoughts, Anna's own work, and creating in general. Anna, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm a junior at Emory University. I'm currently studying computer science and visual arts. I mainly work in the realm of 2D arts, like painting and drawing. Mainly my interest is in life and mainly bodies, humans, and drawing from around me.
Great. Why were you interested in this creativity conversation?
As I said, I'm a visual artist. I'm not the best in music, but I think obviously we all have a connection at some level to music. But I guess I was just really intrigued to see like a different side of how creativity works and how someone else's process is. And like Robert Spano, he obviously is like really talented and he can play a bunch of instruments and he can conduct and compose. And yet there's still certain things where I'm like, I also do that. And like, I can also apply that to what I do in visual art and how I paint and how I go about life.
What were some of the overlaps?
Okay, right at the end, he had one prepared thought about from the creativity conversations. And he said it was about limiting, like creativity is about limiting and like working within parameters and understanding what to restrict. And I thought, I was like, that's literally like, that's exactly like how I also see it. Before all of this, I was like thinking about my own definition of creativity. And I literally wrote down like making something new using constraints of whatever medium you choose. So like mine is definitely more applied to artistic mediums, but it's also the same way in music where you might constrain yourself to certain
instruments
and
yeah,
things like that. So yeah.
I totally agree with that format. I am like an improviser and comedian, writer, that kind of thing. And so improv works great because you get a suggestion from the audience. And even though you don't want to like just do a whole set about pineapples, you get to have, like, you have to force your mind to think outside of like, what does a pineapple connect to? And so you're like, okay, maybe I'll do a scene on a beach. Maybe I'll do something about a porcupine because they're both spiky. But like, you had to come up with that. You had to draw that line for yourself between pineapples. And so I totally understand that benefit of working within a constraint. That is how I work as well as an artist. Talk to me about your own art. So you say, you know, you limit to some of like the more visual arts and the mediums that you try and pursue. And you mentioned that you're more interested in the human form. Did that interest come about because of like your learning how you became a visual artist? Or was it an interesting kind of constraint that you became interested in after learning to draw and paint and all those kinds of things?
I always liked drawing like people and faces especially. I guess that's something I always liked, but I think what recently came up is I kind of got more into figure painting, because before I was really rigid in the way I worked or tried to learn how to draw bodies as well as faces. I mean, I taught myself like everything I know, so it's basically just trying new things constantly. But then like once I took a class and kind of saw the way my professor was doing figure painting and how they did differently, in that way I learned to be more like loose with what I was creating. And I think that opened up something really interesting to me, where I prefer a more loose, not exactly rigid painting of people. I like when you can see a gesture and it's all implied, like what your mind makes up the rest. And I thought that was really interesting because that like really unlocked something new in me, because I used to be like, I don't think I was ever hyper realistic, but I was definitely I stuck to my reference or I stuck to what I saw. And I try to make it match perfectly. I've tried to move away from that more because I like the fact that you can paint something and not have it be exact, but people still see what you saw. I kind of form more of a connection with the work when it's another person as well. I know I talk to other artists, and they're like, if the person in the drawing is making a facial expression, I also will make that facial expression. Like, when I, like, if someone's scared, I'll be like drawing and like with a frightened expression on my face.
I love that. And this idea of translating what you see into your own perspective, as if trying to give your viewers just the tiniest sneak peek into your point of view. Do you have any particular themes that you filter your point of view through? Like, do you tend to paint like happy things or like dark color schemes or things like that?
Now I'm moving towards, I like a good warm tone. I like a good like sepia. I don't necessarily always have a theme. I've been working on this triptych, like self-portrait sort of thing. And like, as I work through each piece, I notice even then, like my own themes evolving, certain like qualities of paint and certain ways I use the brush strokes to evoke different qualities. So even as I go along through this like set of drawings that's like supposed to like a cohesive set, even then each one I'm like, ah, I see, like this one I did a little bit differently, and this one I try to do a little bit more painterly and not super hyper realistic. But I guess I don't necessarily always have a theme, but I like, again, like I try to constrain myself sometimes within certain colors, or I guess the feeling I want to evoke is important.
And I'm thinking about this triptych. Talk to me a little bit more about this. A triptych is, to my understanding, kind of like three pieces that are meant to be seen together.
Mm-hmm, yeah. It started as it was a final project for my advanced painting class, but then everything happened in the world, so a lot of stuff had to be adjusted. But I had just submitted one part of it, and my professor's just like, it's all good. Like, it's a lot of work for just even one, because they're 16 by 20 inch canvases, so it's a lot of ground to cover. And the theme for it was quarantine and how you relate to it, or like what's going on with you. And my theme that I chose was kind of like living with yourself, living with the realities of everything happening. So my first piece was like very, I did multiples of myself. I really liked what I did with that, and it was super cool, and I was very happy with what I did. I still haven't finished the third one, so as you can see, it's still an evolving process, but I plan to. In the second one, I had started painting it in June, when even more stuff started happening, and I kind of was overwhelmed by like news and everything that's going on. So I could see in my painting that in the first one, it was a more like, I'm stuck with myself, but like, you know, quarantine will be over, and like, we'll move on with our lives, and like, it's fine. And then the second one, it's like, I'm sad and the world sucks and everything is horrible. And yeah, I try to evoke that too, like in the painting itself. I try to use sadder colors and more expression, because especially in the first one, I had on purpose, I did do blank stares with my face. I've drawn my face a lot recently, like in the past year. I've drawn myself a lot, so I really have gotten to know like what's going on. I did the blank stares on purpose in the first one, but in the second one, I definitely tried to do more of like a pained expression. And even when I showed my friend, they were like, you look really sad in this. And I was like, that's exactly what I want. Thank you.
I've so enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me and share your craft. And to our listeners, please enjoy this conversation between Robert Spano and Rosemary McGee. It's been edited down from the original YouTube recording. If you'd like to watch the full version, I will link that in the description of this episode.
So, good afternoon, Robert. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here as part of our ongoing series of creativity conversations and joining a group of luminaries, both students and faculty and also visitors who've been to the Emory campus. These conversations have included people like Edward Albee, the evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson, President Jimmy Carter, and others. So, you're a musician, a conductor, a thinker, and now, for us, Professor Robert Spano. And the purpose of this conversation really is to explore the topic of creativity. But let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. When did you first know your life would be devoted to music?
Well, I don't remember. because I never really made up my mind. It was just always there. Mm-hmm. I come from a family of musicians, so it was in the air. It was what everybody did. My mother's parents were both piano teachers. My mother's a pianist. My father's brother was a trumpet player, and my father's a clarinetist and a flute maker. It was just in the house. Mm-hmm. And it's what I did from the time I remember being conscious of anything. I was making music, initially at the piano.
I've heard a story about you and something to do with Mahler. Is that true?
That was an interesting thing, because I think that was in the context of a conversation about what do you need to know to understand pieces of music. And I said, you don't need to know anything, which didn't go over very well. So I tried to explain that as a child, I was probably 11. I think I was 11. And by that time, I was very conscious of being a musician somehow. And I was playing the flute, the violin, the piano. I was writing music, and this was all very important to me. And I heard from all my elder friends, and I had a lot of wonderful influences musically in my life, a lot of teachers, but also just a lot of older friends of my parents who were musical influences on me, even if they weren't my teachers. And everybody always talked about Mahler. And my father hated, and still does, hates Mahler. So I wanted to like it, of course. That's how that works. And I didn't. I really didn't understand anything that was going on. And so I got a recording of the Third Symphony. Those were LPs. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Been a while.
At the public library, and I listened to it over and over and over again. And so I really didn't research Mahler. I listened to the piece without comprehension, mm-hmm. probably 10, 11, 12 times over the course of a month, say. And at some point, it just clicked. And all of a sudden, I understood the intent, the spirit, the emotional content, the message, somehow it resonated, and then I was hooked. Mm-hmm. And from that point, Mahler was a real passion of mine. And I think the reason I was telling that story in that context was that the most important thing about education in music is listening. And so really what I had done was acquire the necessary listening skill set to appreciate Mahler by listening to it. In other words, I think often in music or any artistic endeavor, we look for the explanation or the answer or the piece of information that'll unlock the key, when in fact what's required is a technical skill. The piece of knowledge you already have, but there's a different way of knowing, which is a practice or an engagement or a sensitivity, and that's not a body of knowledge. It's not a communicable piece of information. It's an acquired skill or aptitude or sensibility that I think you can only get by experiencing. And that's often the hardest stuff to talk about, is what you can only know by experiencing. I guess that's why Zen training is so obtuse. Because there's only so much one can say. And then if you don't know, you just don't know.
Well, you've also talked about paying attention, right? The quality of attending to something or paying attention.
I'm fascinated with Indo-European roots. The American Heritage Dictionary, in particular, has a wonderful appendix of Indo-European roots. It's a controversial, to some degree, study of the proto-language behind Sanskrit, Latin, and Greek. What came first? And even though the theory is debatable, the results of the enterprise ends up in wonderful poetry. Because what happens is, if you get to the seed sound or the root of any given word, and then they trace it through various languages, and then you come back to the words in English that are related to each other, there's often just a wonderful kind of constellation of ideas there that are surprising and often insightful. And attention is related to attending, which has to do with serving, but it also has to do with attenuating, so you're stretching something. It's also related to the word tone. So attention has very much to do with music. It's also related to weaving. And so there's this notion of pulling things together. It's related to serving and also extending oneself. So that to pay attention is actually a beautiful turn of phrase, because you get what you pay for. So if you pay attention, you make an investment and then you get a return. But one doesn't get the return unless one pays the investment of attention. And attention is an investment. And that I find that very beautiful, which is what happened with the Mahler.
With Mahler, right. It was a kind of attention to it. So you've talked a little bit about your influences and how you began in music and also reacting to others in the environment. But how does one move from the idea of playing music and performing music and to becoming a conductor. What is that journey like?
We're trying to prevent that globally. I think everybody's different. Anybody who ends up conducting got there by some unique route. I don't know of anyone who's working in the profession who got there the same way. There's often certain common threads. My particular story is that I was engaged in so many instruments and in writing music, and I knew I wanted to be a musician, and I was told and believed that I needed to focus. Well, you can't just keep playing 9 instruments. You're going to have to pick one and play it better.
And so I it literally was 9 instruments or a number of instruments?
Probably by that point, I was just playing the flute, the violin, and the piano. Wow. And writing a lot of music. And I had no desire to pick, and I was stubborn. So I kept playing all of them, and I kept writing music. And then I had a chance to conduct a piece I had written. And because my father was a musician, I knew his friends and colleagues in this orchestra, this community orchestra. And I was too young and stupid to be nervous or afraid, which was great. Mm-hmm. So I just stood up there. I went to my violin teacher, who was the high school orchestra conductor, and she taught me very basic stuff to do on a podium to help people play. And they played my music, and it was just thrilling. I mean, if you get the chance to conduct, take it. Because the best place to hear an orchestra is on the podium, because it's sense around. It's really exhilarating. And they were playing what I'd written. And then the music director of this orchestra said, well, so I finished, and I said, that's fantastic. He said, would you like to rehearse? I said, why? I've never felt that way again. But it was exhilarating, and I realized this was the key for me, that everything I had been doing, it was no longer a question of having to choose from the things I was doing, but rather amplifying on what I'd been doing to serve my desire to do that. So then I added instruments. So instead of focusing on one, I started playing the French horn and the viola and playing double bass in the youth orchestra and oboe and clarinet. And so that was a way of expanding my training with an intention to do this.
So you were pretty clear at that point that was how you
wanted. That was the decision.
That was the decision. How old were you then?
14.
Wow. And then what's the process? How does one, you know, move from the idea of being a conductor to the reality of being a conductor?
Well, for me at that point, it was realizing to add more instruments and expand that musical skill. It also made me realize I wanted to learn the basic European languages that are critical to Western European music, so French, German, and Italian you have to learn to some degree. Started studying scores. I started carrying scores around with me all the time. And then when I was 16, I formed an orchestra, friends.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah, a little entrepreneurial incentive. And I started taking lessons with the associate conductor of the Indianapolis Symphony at that time. He was fantastic. I would go once a month, and he would spend 2 days. One day we'd work for 6 hours, and then we'd go to an Indianapolis Symphony concert, and then the next day we'd work for a few more hours, and then I'd drive home. So it was this fantastic sort of intensive once a month training, and he was a great teacher. So that was terrific. And then I went to conservatory as a composer, because you really don't do undergraduate work in conducting. There's only one program in the country that I know of, and it doesn't quite work. To conduct, you really have to study something useful first.
You have to know something. Well, how is conducting a creative enterprise? Now, if you have a score, and I hand you the score, and you conduct the score, how much of that is a literal reading of the text, and how much of that is your interpretation, your energy, your shaping of that? And I could see how it would differ between perhaps your own work, conducting your own work, and conducting the work of someone else.
Well, I think in many ways that's the lion's share of the work of a conductor, is that text and dealing with it. The interesting thing about musical texts is, even I believe it's fair to say, even more so than with language, it's removed from what's actually going to happen. It's a set of symbols that is in need of interpretation, because sight is not sound. And so those symbols simply are too unrelated to the actual acoustic events to be precise. It's never quite precise. And there was, in the history of Western, it's very interesting. Our notational system in Western European tradition is one of the most elaborate in the world of world music. There are written aspects to other great traditions of music, but they are in no way comparable to the elaborate system we've created. And they're usually just sort of a few jots and mnemonics to activate a whole repertoire of what is essentially an oral tradition, aural and oral. The Indian classical music tradition is that way, the Chinese opera is that way, the Japanese shakuhachi is that way, African drumming is that way, Javanese gamelan. These are all great musical traditions that have no comparable written tradition. We essentially developed a written tradition because we wanted to explore counterpoint. And it is true that Western European music is the one world music that has most deeply explored the possibility of multiplicity of voices with harmony of result. What the Indian classical music tradition affords is a kind of freedom and melodic invention and rhythmic plasticity and a lot of things we gave up, because if you want to have multiplicity of voices and have unity of purpose and result, things have to be predictable. They have to be mapped out. You have to know what the other guy's doing to have it work. And so we started creating maps so that you can have three people singing completely different things and have the composite be something pleasing and agreeable. And that sort of starts in 12th century Paris. And we start getting a more detailed written tradition already at that point, although it's still quite vague. And that flowers to the point where we have J.S. Bach writing some of the greatest contrapuntal music. Now, by the time we get to Bach, the written tradition is quite developed, but Bach is still not telling us many, many things on paper about what it's supposed to sound like. He'll give us the notes, the basic rhythms, but he knew he was going to be in the room. Same with Mozart. There was a kind of, this is a shorthand. We need this much information, and now let's go, guys. All 20 of us, and Mozart or Bach would be at the keyboard overseeing the results, and, you know, I want that this way, but nobody wrote that down. So how long is long, how short is short, how loud is loud, none of that stuff is in the notation, really. With Beethoven, it starts to get more elaborate, and he gets much more, well, because he was philosophizing. He wasn't just writing music. For Beethoven, as he put it himself, music is highest philosophy. So he wanted the documents of his music to be more informative because he was writing for eternity. That was a new kind of attitude, really, which makes him the hero of the 19th century. This whole romantic movement that comes from him has to do with that individualism and that philosophizing in sound that he was doing. So he starts putting more and more information in the score. So now we get more verbal instruction. We get more marks on a given note as to how long it should be or short, more marks about gradations of loud and soft, more marks about when to speed up or when to slow down. There's already a little bit of that, but he starts really doing it. By the time we get to Mahler, there can be volumes on a single page about a single measure in German, turgid German. And so he's really trying to nail it down on paper as to what one should do then to recreate the sound, nail down his intention in a written form. And in the 50s, this goes even further, and we have the serialists marking every note with six or seven markings about exactly how it needs to happen. So there's a lot of micromanaging on the part of the composer. And it's very interesting to me that this happened, because now there's a move in the other direction. Oswaldo Golijov, whom some of you might be aware of, is very much pursuing an oral tradition. And he often jokes about how it's an oral tradition. And in fact, you need to know Golijov or have recordings of his music or be around people who've worked with him to do his music, because the scores are less, they're beyond not helpful. They're misleading. And I had a colleague call me a couple summers ago with, he said, I'm doing Ein Adamar, Oswaldo's opera that we recorded. He said, I've got the score and I've got your recording and I have no idea what to do. And so Oswaldo is not, he's again not so interested in putting it down for posterity because he wants it always to be changing. He embraces this idea that it's never the same in any incarnation of a particular piece. Although certain parameters of it are the same, there are many other things about it that are unique to that occurrence. And he wants to leave that open-ended. He doesn't want to nail it down. Well, that was the long intro to the answer to your question, which is that dealing with the text then becomes a very critical issue for a conductor because it is a map and not the terrain. I've never gotten to California driving on a map. But one studies the map very carefully before making the trip. So there's a lot of work to be done in studying the text, and then there's work to be done in liberating oneself from the text and trying to get the intention. I'm reminded of the parable of the Zen master pointing at the moon and the poor disciple staring at his finger. And really, we have to go to the moon. You know, there's this need to study the text, but then to forget the text, because you have to buy into its intent. And musicians engage in this all the time. And it's a wonderful process. The best example is a string quartet, which is a great study in Freudian psychology, family dynamics. And they generally fight quite a lot. And I'm sorry the Vega Quartet isn't here, because we could talk to them about that. But you know, they have to come to consensus about their decisions, about their interpretation of the text, and how they're going to do it. And there's always disagreement, because these are intelligent, creative people, so there's disagreement. And then someone has to give in, or have their mind changed, or agree to disagree, or let somebody else choose this time and somebody else the next time. But this is a slow and involved process that leads to a very beautiful result that's impossible when you have 100 people on stage.
Right.
In the Soviet Union, they tried to have conductorless orchestras for obvious propaganda purposes, and it didn't work. They simply couldn't get anything done. Someone ultimately has to say, this is the way we're going to do it, or it's just not expedient enough. So that work on the text is paramount for a conductor, to make the decisions about the detail and the reality of sound that the text implies or points to.
So how does that change over time for you if you're conducting a piece, you know, 1 year and then, you know, several years later? Do you use the same score each time? Do you?
No, it varies. Uh-huh. We just did Mahler's Third Symphony, which I had not done for probably 8 years or so, something like that. So I looked at my old score and I said, I got to start over. So I did get a new score. Often I'll use an old score, especially if it's a piece that I do often, and then I mark things a lot. I do a lot of writing. It's a way of processing for me to mark up a score. And if I'm changing my mind, I'll use an eraser or cross things out, or but continue to use the same score. But sometimes I really feel the need of just start with a clean slate.
Mm-hmm. And then have a very different interpretation.
That was fun. After we did the Mahler Symphony this year, I took the score I used this year and took a look at the one I'd used last time again after deciding not to use it. It was amazing how many things I had completely changed my mind, which made me happy because that means I'm not dead.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. So let's move into your role as a professor, where I know you've also worked and taught at Oberlin as well as at Emory. But for our purposes, we'll talk about Emory. For those of you in the audience, Robert has been really generous with his time and energy and has participated in at least 15 classes and maybe more than that, and co-teaching a class with Steve Everett on music and metaphysics, where it's my understanding, in large part, you're focusing on the sonata form. Is that right?
Right. We decided to... Sonata form is sort of the acme of classical music, meaning specifically late 18th century Viennese music. If one looks up the word classical, two of its main definitions are regarding ancient Greece and Rome and regarding late 18th century Viennese music. And I've always been fascinated that the word, is there any reason? Is there any connection? So Steve and I decided to explore what's the connection between ancient Greeks and late 18th century Vienna. And there's actually a lot there. And there's a wonderful thread of thought, musical thought, which is largely speculative and cosmological and philosophical, that one can trace through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, up until Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven are working. And it's really quite beautiful. So we went from Pythagoras to Mozart and exploring how sonata form operates in the sense that as a form, it's not a mold into which one pours content. It's not a fixed set of parameters. It's not definable in terms of length or quantities of material in it, or you can't say what it is by way of description of an object. Mm-hmm. But it is an idea. It is a way of thinking and a way of generating a piece, which is already complicated. We talk about pieces of music. It's really quite wonderful how language fails us when we talk about music or misleads us. But it's a way of generating a piece of music that has properties that make it possible for us to talk about sonatas as having something in common. And that's a wonderfully elusive, there are ways to make it very simple. And we could, but that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to complicate the matter. Because it's actually much more interesting than the simplistic version. I mean, I could tell you that a sonata form is you get a theme in one key, then you get a theme in another key. Then you have a development. Then you recapitulate what you did the first time, only now that second theme is now in the key of the first theme when you bring it back. Well, that's largely true to an extent until you start looking at actual sonatas and symphonies which are in sonata form or other pieces which are in sonata form but aren't called a symphony or a sonata, and that happens too. So when you start really looking at what's there and what we call a sonata, it's this rich, wonderful world. And why are what makes them what they are, and why do they have something in common? And it's actually a kind of Platonic idea, which then composers generate material almost in an organic way, like DNA or something. And there's a flowering of material that results in this piece that we call a sonata. So that's been the fascination. And tracing the thinking that's behind that and how it flowers into this, I think one of the great achievements of Western civilization is sonata form. I mean, it pervades our musical thinking now in ways that we're not always conscious of.
Well, as you were talking about that, it actually made me think about some of the earlier things that you were saying about the different strands of music coming together. And how is being a conductor like being a professor?
I guess it depends who you're conducting. Mm-hmm. Because there are certainly occasions when, as a conductor, you really become a teacher. And then there's more of the time, say, in my work with the ASO, where I'm more of a colleague with a little more authority. So it's really chamber music, and I get to be the first violinist. So when push comes to shove, I get to decide. But it's still chamber music in the sense that I want to hear the musical insight and input of my players, because they're brilliant, talented, insightful, musical people that bring a richness to the process that I don't want to miss. So when Christina Smith, our principal flute, starts Afternoon of a Faun, I'm not interested in influencing her. I'm interested in having her influence me. Right. And in fact, the way she starts that piece will influence the way I do the rest of it, because I always leave her alone when she starts that piece. That's her business. But she'll do it differently every time, and she sets us up for once something, it's to me one of the marvelous mysteries in music is that once something happens, it implies things about what has to happen next. With whatever happened, everything else is predicated on that at every moment. So as soon as something happens, then something else happens, and it's dominoes. You know, it affects everything. In Greek mythology, the mother of the nine muses is Mnemosyne, memory, the goddess memory. And just the idea that memory would be the mother of art, I find very beautiful. And because there is something in our, and as Heidegger looks at that, Heidegger talks about memory not just in the sense of remembering, but memory in the sense of collecting our experience so that not only are we remembering what just happened, but with that process of memory, we're also projecting what we expect. So our it's a refractive process, so that this happened, which means I'm expecting something. And then the game of music is always, are those expectations fulfilled or surprised? And really, I think that has a lot to do with our enjoyment of music, is that what we just heard leads us to believe we're going to hear something next, and a composer delights us by satisfying it or by surprising us or by shocking us. But without that process on our own part of attention and memory, we're not engaged in that dialogue with the musician. So it's really, for me, where the music exists is between us. If I'm playing and you're listening, you're the musician as much as I am.
Right.
Because it's that circle of attention that creates the event.
It's about the attention. I heard in response to one of the students asked you in a group about what do you think about when you're conducting? And your answer was that you think musically. And I guess I'd like to know more about what that means, what that sounds like or feels like or looks like. And also, can you teach that to me? Can I learn to think musically too?
Well, we'll give you a few tests and we'll find
okay,
out.
Okay, not right now. Later.
I think it can be taught, except for people for whom it can't be taught. In the same way that I don't think anyone could teach me how to dance, because I'm not so inclined. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to have that. I'm never going to be a ballet dancer. That's just not happening.
Right.
You know
probably,
what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm never going to be an artist. I don't think I have a visual. I'll never be a painter. I could probably develop some skill, and I could maybe even become quite competent, but it's not in my makeup. It's not my proclivity. I'm not attuned to it. And I think people do have, and we witness it in small children, they have predispositions mm-hmm. for things, and that's talent. And as a colleague of mine at Oberlin always liked to say, no talent is forever, which is,
wow.
which is worth recognizing. So can it be taught, I think, is a question that needs that in it, mm-hmm. awareness first,
right.
which is not to just anybody. Mm-hmm. But it can be taught, and it's, again, the kind of thing where it's not a piece of knowledge, but it's a practice. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately the teaching of it comes from the person engaged in a practice to teach themselves, and you can guide them in that process. But this was all in answer to can it be taught, and the thing that we're talking about teaching is the ability to think musically. Our language has a lot of clues to the inner eye. We say, picture this, or, you know, I can see that happening.
Or you have a vision.
Right, and we speak of visionaries. Mm-hmm. Or we talk about the mind's eye. Now let's try and say the mind's ear. The language gets very common, but we can say audiate. It's very clumsy. We don't say it. We don't use it. It's not in our mm-hmm. auralize. These things sound ridiculous. But it's what we do. It's what any musician does is activate an inner ear, an inner stereo. Mm-hmm. That whole game of dealing with the text. Actually, one wants to get to the point where by looking at the text, one is vividly hearing the music in one's mind's ear. It's an imaginative process that has to do with sound in the same way the imaginative process can use sight. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us are good at closing our eyes and picturing something. I think most people do this in some way, any way we talk about it. But you can do it too with your ears. Closing one's eyes somehow helps, but if you close your eyes and try and remember some piece of music that you know or some recent musical experience, you can play it back in your imagined hearing, in your imaginary ear. And that's the work of reading a text as a musician, is to create that paradigm. The nice thing about having an inner stereo is you can get perfect performances. And that's what can be cultivated. That's what can be taught. There are very specific kinds of exercises musicians engage in to cultivate the inner ear and to increase the capacity to hear very precisely and clearly in the imagination.
So what about the state of music in our culture? Because it's rare that we go someplace and we don't have music in the background or music, you know, right in our ear playing all the time. Do you think that heightens our awareness or our ability to think music or desensitizes us?
I think it's desensitizing us, and I think it's very dangerous.
Mm.
And I think we should turn it off. There was a wonderful group of musicians in England who were against music. they were making public pleas to turn off. And I remember Lily Tomlin once saying, my greatest fear is that whoever invented Muzak is out there inventing something else. There is something about having music constantly playing that teaches us to ignore it. Mm-hmm. Because we have to, I mean, we have all kinds of good studies about how we have to tune things out in order to focus. Right. And one only has to live in any dense urban environment for a short period of time to realize how much you learn to ignore mm-hmm. just to get through the day. And if you're going to maintain your ability to focus on the things you care about and devote your attention to those things, the first concern is to block out all the distraction. And in fact, this pervasive music is something people don't pay attention to it. I mean, you can notice. And I often find myself paying attention to it against my will, and I'll mention something about what's playing to the people around me, and no one's noticed even that something's playing, let alone what it was or what happened. We don't pay attention to it. I think there's something wrong with it. Well, it's like anything. If you have chocolate 5 times a day, it loses its, well, maybe so, for
really?
Some people. But, you know, it loses its luster. At a certain point, it's not special anymore.
Right.
And
it demeans the music.
Exactly. So we don't pay attention to it. And I don't think all music is meant to be listened to attentively. I mean, certainly Mozart wrote music where he knew it was being played at dinner, and he wasn't going to pour his best work into that. And so it was meant to be part of the furniture. And that can be festive and wonderful. I certainly know the experience of having music in a certain social setting where it's a welcome part of an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But if we have that all the time, should we be partying all the time? I'm not convinced. Uh-huh. And they put music on in the lobby of my condo building, and I'm thinking about moving. It's just horrible to come home and have something playing, whatever it is. It's just horrible.
Well, speaking of where you live, I've heard that you have a place full of books. And so I'm wondering what kinds of books and what your favorites are among those.
Oh, favorites are hard, aren't they?
And we spent a bit of time over at the library together, and you just seemed like, you know, that was a place where you would love to live.
Yeah, libraries are heaven. I do read a lot. I'm sort of constantly exploring because I find that what I'm interested in changes, and if I'm pursuing one thing, it leads to, I keep thinking of Ecclesiastes, of the making of many books, there is no end. Because what happens to me is I'm reading this thing, and then it goads me to read this other thing, and that means, oh, I've got to read that. And often it ends up being a real circus, and it's wonderful. I love how that can happen. And I end up reading things I never would have thought I would be interested in, because I got there
one
by some...
One leads you to the other.
Yeah. But I do read a lot of philosophy, and a lot of poetry, and a lot of theology and world religion. I do love a lot of modern fiction. There's a lot of living and not so recently deceased authors that I particularly love. I've collected a lot of books as objects because I love them, first editions and signed copies. And there's addictive properties here that are dangerous, but they're such beautiful things to me. Kendall just doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the themes, one of the recurring themes that even today, but also in other discussions that you've participated in, is this reference to philosophy. And a course that you've been participating in also is on Wagner and Schopenhauer. And so the relationship between music and philosophy, but also what is it that you're seeking in your study and reading and experience of philosophy?
I guess I like the mystery. And I'm not sufficiently Catholic to leave the mystery alone. I'm not willing to just let it be the evidence of things unseen. I'm interested in torturing myself with not being able to answer the hard questions, because I find that process really rewarding. So after class last night, we went out, the students, and Andrew and Kevin was with us for a while. This is the Wagner, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche course that two professors are teaching, one from philosophy, one from music. They're both brilliant, and the students are music students and religion students and comparative lit and philosophy, and so it's about a dozen students in this seminar, and they're brilliant, and this class just sent me through the roof with excitement when I first went, and I kept going back uninvited. And last night we had such great discussions in the class, they were sort of continuing.
What were you talking about? What was the subject?
Well, we were getting to the questions that philosophers in the last few decades have been loath to ask, questions that are shameful almost. You know, the questions that started the practice of philosophy in Greece, like, why are we here? Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of human life on earth? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to live a good life? Or, you know, pick any Platonic dialogue. It's out of fashion. So, and we were joking about Quine, the great logician, because I had picked up some Quine the other day, which was almost all written in mathematical symbols as opposed to English. So we were getting to that level of philosophy, and it's in the word, the love of wisdom, and there's something in that I'm drawn to always, even not so that one gets an answer necessarily, but somehow I think we come closer to an understanding by attempting it, by engaging a question that doesn't have a ready answer. And I think also that at a certain point, certain ideas are about our being and not about our knowing, and actually act as enzymes in our system that transform us. I think such things are real. That if you carry an idea, whatever it might be, seriously with you, it can change you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be highfalutin. It can be, we picked one in Steve Everett's class last week. I asked the students if they'd be willing to take the idea of Aristotle's, which was never hurry. Which is really an interesting idea to carry around in our world. And it doesn't mean don't go fast. Mm-hmm. It has to do with an inner attitude.
Right.
Never hurry, try it. It's an idea that can act as a catalyst for something in us that has to do with our experience, which is very different from carrying around a body of knowledge, mm-hmm. but maybe even more valuable.
It's a way of being.
I certainly am not capable of practicing never hurry very well, but I find that if I carry the idea with me, I experience my life a little differently, and some things change, and I get a different kind of enjoyment out of certain aspects of my life, and I also can get things done faster when I'm not in a hurry. And any good musician knows the principle of never hurry, because when you're playing very fast music, if you feel like you're going fast, you're rushing and you're making a mess. And so you learn it as a musician that when you're playing fast music, you've got to feel like it's not very fast. You feel like you're in control. Everyone else experiences as whizzing by, but you're sufficiently familiar with it and acquainted and masterful of it that you're not in a hurry. It's an interesting feeling as a performer where you know the fingers are flying, but your sensibility is Aristotelian in the sense of never hurry. So it has this.
Do you
quality.
Have to resist that as a conductor, not to
Absolutely.
Push it along?
Absolutely.
Get to the finish.
Yeah. Or sometimes you have to do that.
Right, right. But make it happen.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other things that you're interested in, so I've gathered over the time you've been here, and that we're preparing for next year, is music within a cultural and social context, and how it's shaped by this context, how the world of music is shifting even as we are talking right now, and how we access it, how it's produced, with the role of symphony orchestras in our culture. So, and kind of in preparation for the course that you'll be participating in next year, why don't we explore some of those ideas, what your fascination is?
Well, Rosemary's amazing because, how long ago was it? A few months ago?
Yeah.
I came to you and I said, next year I really want to do something about how we experience music, in the sense that it's not just in concert halls or opera houses, there's music for ritual and rite. There's music in all kinds of religious settings in the world. There's music that's used by slave laborers to unify their efforts. There's music that's used to keep criminals away from parking lots. There's music that's used for dancing and is not meant to be listened to without dancing to it. There's music that we use to change our experience of the day with the way we're now capable of playing recorded music. We have radios and iPhones and pods and tunes, and we have so many ways that we access music. And historically, there are so many ways that music has happened in society. An event of Balinese monkey chant is not a concert in the way that we understand it in a Western European sense. And concerts, as we understand them, were not concerts as the 18th century understood them. So I'm interested in it historically as well as currently, and the whole gamut of how we experience music, what we are doing with it, how we're making it, how we're accessing it, and especially since we're in a time where there's tremendous change. In the last 100 years, the fact of recorded music is already extraordinary. I think it's hard for us to imagine a world without recorded music, because we're so accustomed to it. But you know, for Debussy to hear Gamelan, he had to hear it live. They had to have the World's Fair in Paris. The expo, when was that, 1896?
Something like that.
I think something like that. And he hears Gamelan for the first time, and you hear it affect his music, infect his music. You know, it suddenly, Debussy's engaged with this whole other world tradition of music, and it alters his musical thinking, and it's fantastic. I mean, this cross-pollination is exhilarating. And now, if I want to hear Japanese shakuhachi, I press a button.
Right there.
Bach had to walk 300 miles just to hear Buxtehude. And the name says it all. There's a take-it-for-granted aspect, I think, for how we live with music now that I'd love to explore. And so, Rosemary, I'm saying, is there anyone who's studying this who could help me? Is there a sociologist, perhaps, who's looking at our behaviors as people in relation to music? And Timothy Dowd appears in a meeting a few weeks later, working on all this material himself for years anyway, with a stable of graduate students, his henchmen, digging into this material. And it was just so exhilarating that I had this notion, and then there's this person whose expertise is exactly in that area. So I'm working with him next year to pursue it from that end. The reason I wanted to look at it in that way is the focus next year musically, as this year was the sonata, next year is American music in the 20th and 21st century. And one of the reasons I wanted to pursue it from this sociological point of view is I think examining American music in the 20th century and now has a lot to do with how it's changed and our way of experiencing music has changed, not only with technology, but with changes in the way we live socially.
What about the role of symphony orchestras in the world as it's changing? What's your prognosis there?
Well, I think the motto for the American Symphony Orchestra League these days is mired in the past, afraid of the future.
That's inspiring.
Yeah. The reality is that orchestras nationally are in trouble. And I'm glad, personally, because since I've been alive, people have been talking about how the model, the business model, the structure of a symphony orchestra in America is flawed and unsustainable. Well, they've been saying that as long as I've been alive, but we haven't fixed it. And in fact, what's happening in the last couple of years is, given the current financial crisis that everyone's experiencing, that unsustainability is being exacerbated to the point where people are having to do something about it. And we're having to re-examine and rethink. And I think it's fantastic. I feel very positive about it, because I think there was something wrong with that which was unsustainable far more than just the financial end of it. I think the financial unsustainability of it reflected a moribund attitude on the part of the institutions and a lack of creativity and a sitting back that the work is done. And in any art form, the work is never done. Mm-hmm. And in any creative endeavor, you're never finished. And there's this notion that there's somehow 100 years of German music that we play ad nauseum, however great it may be, and we do it as professionals. The whole idea, as Robert Shaw said, music is like sex. It shouldn't be left to the professionals. And if you put it if you put it in the hands of professionals, they can kill it. There's been all my life this conversation about, well, are orchestras actually promoting the creativity of their members? Or, and we've all seen orchestra concerts that look like that. And that's death of music. And so I think it's great that the whole thing is blowing up. I think it's great that the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the richest orchestra in the country, had to lay off staff. I think it's great that Atlanta is now challenged in such a way that we have to reconfigure and re-examine and shake it up and figure out better ways to foster genuine, creative spark, interest, excitement, in the interest of greater financial sustainability, great, but also in the interest of art, that it's not possible to give a good performance of anything if you think you know it. You have to reimagine it every time. You have to engage it anew every time. What were we doing recently? Oh, I said it in rehearsal. We were rehearsing The Rite of Spring, and I said, you know, if we play this like we know it, it's not going to be any good. And everybody sort of knew what I meant. But if you take for granted what you think you know, you're no longer creatively invested. And if you're not re-examining the thing you think you know, you're no longer putting out at a level that should be expected of any creative artist or of any performer. We want anyone engaged in that work to be giving us their all, because that's the thrill we get as perceivers, is that somebody's operating at peak. That's why we watch the Olympics. We thrive on the notion of achieving things that seem impossible for human beings to achieve. And if we're not engaged at that level, then there's something wrong. And I think there's been something wrong, and I think it's not going to be allowed to go on. And I'm not worried about the art, because it's fine. The art itself. Mm-hmm. Music will always be fine. If we're not accessing it with symphony orchestras as we've known them, that grew up and were created for a society that's very different from the one we live in, I don't see the problem. And if we're not adaptable enough to figure out who we need to be vital, vibrant, and connected to the society we're living in, then there's no point sticking around. So I find it all exhilarating.
So what do you think it'll look like in the future?
Don't know.
Don't know.
That's the
unknown.
Best part.
It's unknown. Well, Robert, just to kind of a culminating question, what is it that you want the students to get out of their experience with you here? And what are you gaining from your interaction with the students?
I think for me, the reward is in the insight they bring. Last night for me was a great example. The class on Wagner and Nietzsche was very exhilarating for me because those are two of my passions. I conduct Wagner and I've read Nietzsche since I was in high school. So that was just a natural fit. But then they were reading Adorno, who I despise. And so I reread Adorno for the class. And it was wonderful for me because there were especially two students who are Adorno fanatics in the same way that I'm a Nietzsche fanatic. So they were able to bring insight to me to have a deeper appreciation of Adorno that I could not have had without that interaction, because I would have just gone on wishing him eradicated from the canon. And they really helped me get a handle or an insight into an appreciation of what he was trying to accomplish that I never would have had otherwise. So I, on one level, it's simply the interaction is of such benefit to me because of the multiplicity of perspective that's present. And in terms of what I would hope to bring, I'm trying to think of a better way to put it than I did a few years ago when we had dinner about this whole project in the first place, which was I would want to confuse people. But I don't know that I can put it any better way. So I'm hoping I'm leaving people a bit confused.
Well, I'm not sure there's much more to say beyond that, except except that I'm sure it's clear to everyone here why it makes so much sense for Robert to be a part of our community.
Should we say anything about creativity?
No, it will just be very confusing.
Well, actually, I had one prepared thought I came
okay,
here.
Okay, all right. Go for it.
It was the only one, which was the idea of creativity. I maybe have said this too much these few weeks, but I think it's important because I think it's a deceptive thing. We generally think about creativity being making something up or creating something from nothing or inventing something or finding something new, where in fact creativity is often about eliminating things. The creation of identity means rejecting things that don't fit that identity. To create something often has to do with restriction and delimiting. In Kabbalistic theory, the Jewish mystical tradition, the process of creation starts with the point. Well, it starts with nothing. And then you have the point, which is one, and then you have two, which is a dynamic interplay of forces, but quite unstable. And then you need a third force that's to combine them, to synthesize. It's Hegelian, in a sense, if you want to do that route, or it's a proton, a neutron, and an electron, if you want to do that, or you can do the Holy Trinity, or you can do the three gunas of Indian philosophy. But in any way, you end up with the notion of three, that you need a third element to stabilize the dynamic force of two, and that third element in Jewish mystical thought is restriction. It's that which encompasses something. We all come from a womb. It's creating something has to do. Debussy said, "I take all the notes," when he was asked how he composed. "I take all the notes and I leave out the ones I don't like," which is, and maybe the best example is sculpture, because there it's very clear, and from the way Michelangelo talked about his own work, that his work was about revealing the sculpture out of the stone by getting rid of everything that was in the way. So it's for me a very important, when I try and work on my own creative work, it's an important facet for me to remember, I find, because the other way I often find myself drawing blanks. But if I approach creating something from the end of how am I defining it? How am I giving it identity? How do I limit it, encompass it, enclose it, make it a something instead of an amorphous nothing?
Can you give an example of that, how you've done that in a creative work or process?
For me, the easiest thing is writing music. Mm-hmm. And it's where it's very interesting right now in the world of music that the sky is the limit. If you were writing music in 18th century Vienna, you knew what vocabulary to use that really wasn't up in the air. You didn't have to think about that. There was an existing vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Now, you could play with the parameters of that, but you basically spoke late 18th century Viennese tonal music. That was the language, and that's what you spoke. We now have any composer in America now has every and any language available to them, musical language. And you can do whatever you want. So to write a piece of music, the first thing you have to do is decide what language or combination thereof you're going to engage. And so that's a process of limiting yourself. And so in fact, when you start writing a piece of music, one of the quickest ways to get it rolling is to define your limits. I've had more success writing pieces when I've said, I can only do this. I'm not going to permit myself to go outside these restrictions. I'm going to play this game. Then I'm able to start creating something because I know it's limits. And of course, you can change the rules as you go along, but that's a great way to get something going. And Stravinsky was very eloquent about getting something on paper for him. And the way he put it was then he worked with his materials until they started talking back to him, which I thought was really beautiful. So if you can get a piece of material defined, limited, restricted, identifiable, then it starts to help you. But if you aren't able to draw the line and focus in on the thing, it's very hard to accomplish anything because you stay in that amorphous soup.
So it's also about paying attention, if you will. Excluding.
What?
It's also about, yes, that's right. And creating those kinds of limits. You also hear many writers talk about, you know, the voices that they hear and that they serve as a medium then for those voices.
Right.
Well, thank you for introducing creativity into the conversation. I knew we were going to get there. Many thanks to you, Robert.
Thank you very much.
you for listening to this episode of Creativity Conversations. This podcast was brought to you by Emory University and Arts at Emory. It was produced by Emma Yarbrough and me, Maggie Becker. For the full version of this conversation, you can find it on the Creativity Conversations YouTube playlist linked in the description of this episode. For more from Arts at Emory, be sure to follow us on Facebook at Arts at Emory and on Instagram at Emory Arts.